reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. You know, I'm afraid to lose my voice here too. Text 10. Te pati pasava eya shukshma. Those kleshas are subtle. They are destroyed when the mind dissolves back into its original nature. Commentary. Vyasa's only comment here is that when the mind of the yogi has fulfilled its purpose, that is when the yogi has attained a permanent state of near beach samadhi, it dissolves back into prakriti. As Shankara puts it, no fire is needed for something that has already been burnt, nor grinding water for what has already been ground. The mind, having fulfilled its objective, becomes redundant. The five kleshas are lodged in the mind, consequently becoming like seeds as discussed above. They too are dissolved along with it. Patanjali in Sutra 2.4 referred to only four possible states for the klesha: dormant, weak, intermittent, or fully activated. Well, we recall that Vyasa, in his commentary for that sutra, suggested that the burnt state constituted a fifth state. The Chaspati Mistra suggests that in this sutra, Patanjali is indirectly confirming that fifth state. This is a good example of how Vyasa's commentary has become almost as canonical as Patanjali's original text. It is almost never questioned by all subsequent commentators, but reinforce. The task of the traditional exegete is not to probe if an authoritative text is true, but how it is true. Om Gyanatimarandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Daksurutamyena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Vanchara-pampa-churu-pyascha Vipa-sindhu-bhaye-vicha Patita-nam-pavane-vyo Vaishnave-vyo-namo-namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasa Devora Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna Krishna, Krishna, Hare, Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare, Hare. So greetings from the Sun Falls, where I base myself when I'm in America. Next Wednesday I leave, but I do want the classes to continue. So, because my flight is actually the same time that this class is, I've asked Mahamuni to give a class on the six darshans. Yoga is one of darshans, means to see, or a philosophical view. In Indian philosophy, eventually, the different aspects of philosophy became categorized into six. Samkhya and yoga, Mimamsa and Vaisheshika, Nyaya and Vedanta. So it's very, very relevant to this study. So he'll discuss a brief summary of what those six philosophies are. So it'll be continued, the class, tomorrow, next week, even though I can't attend it. And then I'll continue the next week and where I left off. So this section two is about the yoga of action, and the first chapter in these Patanjali Sutras was meditative absorption. which requires a high level, a high level of sattva, a very, very purified state of the mind, to begin that practice to further purify the mind. But that's really what yoga is. Really, yoga is that very concentrated practice, which helps one experientially develop such a high level of discrimination that one can clearly see the difference between the soul in this school of thought called the Purusha and the body or matter. It's gross and subtle, subtle body and the gross body, which is called Prakriti. And one is eventually able to disentangle oneself from that which is the non-self, but one is unfortunately identifying with. And that's really the culmination of the yoga process. So the question arises, what if you're not in that level of mode? Well, then you can purify yourself by Kriya Yoga, which will also bring you to samadhi, and it will destroy the core root conceptions in the mind that bind one to this body. They're called kleshas, literally meaning trouble. But what is the trouble? The trouble is the conceptions that bind us in the bodily conception, because all trouble is based on that misconception. The example is someone sleeping, he's healthy, he's dreaming he has a disease. All trouble is based on that misconception that the person has. So it's called klesha. It's misconceptions, but they're trouble because they bring one away from the realization of the soul, and only when you imbibe or live in your pure nature will you be happy. This conception comes through all Indian philosophy that the true nature of being is satisfying, eternal, and full of knowledge. So when you can actually get a perspective on reality, which begins with the desire for truth, and in bhakti process, not just the desire for truth, but the love of truth. We have to love truth. We have to desire truth. And therefore, we have to hear about truth. It's so essential. That's really the purpose of this class. I'm hoping I can be transparent to these shastras. But I'm availing this opportunity to to people, because I want to give an opportunity to hear about truth so you can desire truth. And hopefully you can love truth. And of course, when you love truth, you embrace it, you embrace truth deeper. So that meditative process is a psychosomatic process to do that. But this Kriya Yoga, which has three aspects of tapasya, which is austerity, simplicity, swadhyaya, which is study, and mantra chanting, basically, and Ishvara Pranidhan, which in this context means basically to actively dedicate your life and dedicate your activities to God. Karma yoga, but not just disinterested work, but work that is meant to please God. So, and that will bring about samadhi, this Kriya Yoga, and it will burn these kleshas, these root core conceptions. I was thinking, what's the difference between samskaras, mental imprints, and klesha? Well, not all samskaras have to be caused by klesha. It can be caused by not misconceptions, but you can have mental imprints by proper conceptions, discriminatory conceptions, devotional conceptions. You can have imprints in your consciousness of attraction to God. So klesha means the root of the bondage, which is with the basis of ignorance, and all the kleshas are different manifestations of ignorance. So he lists five, beginning with avidya or ignorance, then asmita, which is ego. It basically means to misidentify the seer with the instrument of seeing. That's ego. When it's a false conception of the self, we identify the mind. The mind is desiring a feminine conception. The mind is desiring a masculine conception. The mind is desiring an ethnic conception. The mind is hating, it's accepting, it's liking. To think that that's actually you, that mental process is you, then that's ego. And to act on that conception, to act on the basis of that ego, that's what the cause of karma is. So anytime you act based on that ego, then that's karma. And karma is meant to destroy that conception of ego by the reactions you get acting on the basis of ego. It's so healthy to not act on ego, but to act out of devotion or act out of discrimination. And that's the whole Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna wanted to act on the basis of ego. That saying, I'm of this family, I am this, you know, so many egoistic conceptions based on not the real identity, and to act on those rather than act on with devotion or act with discrimination. And therefore, the whole Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna was afraid that the activity was going to cause karma. But Krishna is going to say, well, if it only causes karma if you act on that platform. But if you act as a devotee of me, or you act with discrimination, which may take in consideration what your mental identifications are. But you're not just acting on your mental identification. You're acting on the platform of knowledge. Okay, I have attachment to the body in this way. Now, how do I act? So it's not egotistical, but it's purifying. So there's ego, and then there's attachment, which means what pleasure is perceived because of previous memory. And then aversion is just the opposite, where you become averse to something due to some memory of some unpleasant experience. And then finally there was clinging to life, which is a samskara. And it's an attachment, but it's the most deep attachment, and it's the most deep aversion, which is the fear of death, which means that we've experienced this in our previous life, and it's so bad that, you know, we're tormented by that fear because it was such a bad experience. And therefore, you know, unlike, we don't want to be born again. You know, and we want to transcend this conception. This whole material conception is temporary. Identify, and that's the, what have they defined ignorance? To identify the self, which is joyful and pure and full of knowledge, with the non-self, which is unclean and miserable, to identify that. The root of suffering. so clinging, so that experience we had, identifying with this temporary as the real, and therefore we become in the illusion that we will become non-existent. And there can be no greater fear than becoming non-existent. You lose everything. And therefore there's such a clinging to life. Even when it's not beneficial for us, even when we have to stick tubes in our bodies and live in pain. Okay, now we're going to go a little further today. And it says the kleshas are subtle. They are destroyed when the mind dissolves back into its original matrix. That means these kleshas, these conceptions that are embedded in the mind, will remain until we come to that platform of subpragyata samadhi, or until one comes to that platform, at least in this yoga philosophy, yoga, until the total, because remember, there's near beach and sub beach. What is near beach? Without support of the mind. Initially, you have a samadhi where your conception of the self and your focus is with support of the material mind. So even at that level of samadhi, that level of focus, where the kleshas have been burnt, it's like a seed when it's burnt, it's not active. Even at that platform, though, there's always a possibility of even that part seed unexpectedly sprouting. And there's even, you know, some of these yogis that came from the West, to the West, some of them were very accomplished Himalayan masters. And therefore that meant that the sex desire was burnt. They weren't experiencing it. They weren't feeling it. They may have been even, but when they came to the West in that type of culture, confronted intimately with the objects of sex desire, then even these seeds sprouted again and then brought them from that level, because there's stories of some of these yogis that became famous in America that they've actually had significant yogic accomplishments from years and years of meditation. But here it says that they're subtle, so they can stay in that parched or burnt state, but they're finally destroyed only when one transcends the mind altogether. And that's what he's explaining there. Because when the yogi has attained that state, there's no need. The mind has a purpose to the mind, the body has a purpose to facilitate our desire to be the enjoying controller, a position we cannot have in truth or reality. So it's fulfilled in a type of illusion, where the consciousness becomes reflected on the body, identifies with the body, and then plays out this role of enjoyer and controller. But once that is given up totally and completely, then these kleshas are destroyed. And that's what's being said here. Then it says the state of the mind produced by these kleshas are eliminated by meditation. So what this basically means, because meditation is jhana. Jhana is dharana, dhyana, samadhi. They are the three higher stages of Astanga Yoga. That's the stages where it's actually meditative absorption or yoga. So what it describes here is that even though Kriya Yoga can help one achieve samadhi, but the way it helps one achieve samadhi is that by austerity and service to God, giving one's life to God, and swadhyaya, the proper study, and based on that study, the devotional chanting, and this type of process, it will purify one to the point of sattva or goodness, where one can fix the mind for a long period and get that level of discrimination where you can transcend. So eventually it has to come in the yoga process to this level of meditative absorption to eliminate completely these kleshas or these conceptions that bind in ignorance the self with the non-self and fill our minds with attachments and aversions and clinging to life and egoism, and which the ignorance leads to egoism. The egoism leads to attachment, aversion, and clinging to life, which bind us to this body. It's just a reality check, you know. I guess the end of this week is my 59th birthday. I'm getting old. and it's supposed to be God's grace to waking you to the facts and the truth that this body is temporary, and to inspire you to get out of this mad samsara of suffering again and again and again. Bhutva, bhutva, pariyate, again and again destroyed. Why? To make you embrace the truth and love the truth. And when you embrace the truth and love the truth, you can live eternally in the truth. And we can give up this desire to enjoy, which puts us in the illusion that we are the enjoyer and controller. Because we're not. It only puts us in the illusion that we're the enjoyer and controller. And so this Kriya Yoga, it weakens these kleshas, which are binding us. We can feel it. How we are driven into the bodily conception of life by these kleshas. So they're weakened by this Kriya Yoga and finally completely eradicated by meditative absorption. And the commentators describe it as like a cloth. You want to clean it, you may first shake it out, and then, which removes like the gross pieces of dirt, and then you add a cleaning agent, you wash more carefully and beat it with a stone, and this removes more of the ingrained dirt. But to really eliminate all the dirt, you have to destroy the cloth. So the mind, which is produces these kleshas, the kleshas can only be stirred, can only be finally eradicated when you transcend the material engagement. In Vaishnav conception of samadhi and elevation, there is Sarup City and Vastu City, that we finally get a glimpse or conception of the self. And then it becomes substantial. It becomes substantial. We actually get a spiritual body. And then it says the stock of karma has the kleshas as its root. It is experienced in present or future lives. So Now it's getting to the point of karma. And karma are the reactions to egotistical activity based on this false conception. And the reactions are meant to liberate us from this conception. It's the law of God to purify ourselves of kleshas, actually, of deep-rooted misconceptions that are the root of all suffering. So they cause karma. It's the root. It's the stock. You have a stock of karma. And, you know, we'll find out today. I'm going to read a little bit from the purports. I think it's going to be quite interesting and revelatory about these karma. And it says it's experience in present or future lives. So if you intensely, some scars, the intensity of your egotistical activities create a mental imprint, and if that mental imprint is deep enough, then you will experience the reaction to those activities even in this life, if not in the future life. The activities are performed intensely, they can bear the fruits during the present life, either good or bad. So good karma means austerity, chanting mantras, worshiping God. So if it's done intensely, you can experience the fruits in this life. And it gives bad karma, exploitation, or you can also experience that in this life. So he's describing the intensity of karma. Because it's trying to inspire us in yoga. That's really what these verses are. Now we know how the process works. Now, if we're not on the platform of yoga, and we're on the platform of the ego, where we are seeing the mind or the instrument of seeing as the seer or the self itself, and we're acting on that platform, then this karma is produced. So he's describing something about this karma. And he gives different stories of one, a youth called Nandishvara. And he was so intensely performing pious activities, so intensely. Do we intensely perform pious activities? Do we intensely perform devotional activities? So intensely he performed that within the life, from a human life, he received a celestial one. And then there's also a story that's told of Nahusha, who was so arrogant and so offensive that he was cursed by a sage to immediately abandon his celestial form. We have to be so, it's so unfortunate when people become obsessed with criticism of Vaishnavas, hate of Vaishnavas. They become obsessed. They'll create such impressions in the consciousness that they can lose their spiritual status very easy in this one life. So karma has the klesha at the root, because the klesha are the core materialistic sentiments and conditioning within the chitta, and that's what causes karma. And it's all stored within the chitta. It's all stored within the mind. And it can manifest in this life or the next. It's transferred to the next life. So when you die, it's very interesting. I'll give the description. You know, not all your karma can be given in one life. And they give the example of, you know, some child was very, very pious, but when he grew up, he became corrupted, and he acted very beastly somehow. So he had some pious activities, then he had some very beastly activities. And at the end of life, the mind was the beastly activities were more prominent, like Ajneel, because he fortunately chanted the holy name. So what happens in the next life, you can't have both a beastly and human life. So even if transferred to the animal, it'll be stored, the human karma. And it'll take a beastly form, karmically. And this is how karma works. Because it's stored in this in the samskaras in the chitta. And they may fructify. And he states, what's the particulars of one's life? The type of birth you have is your karma. The quality of life experience is your karma. Your lifespan is your karma. They're the fruits of your karma. But ultimately, they have the klesha at the root. It's a mula. And it's a klesha that influences one to act one way or another. These kleshas perform karma, and karma then fuels the kleshas, and one becomes entangled in this world. And, let me see what else today I didn't cover. As long as the root of kleshas exist, it fructifies as a type of birth, span of life, and life experience. So, you know, who knows what's stored in there that could not manifest in this life, that will have to suffer in the next life unless we uproot, unless we eradicate the root of our karma. Who knows what's waiting? Who knows what's waiting for the next life to fructify? How long we've been into this world? This is reality that one has to intelligently face and become inspired. Inspired to take up the appropriate path. So your bhoga, the pleasure and pain, it's the end of your last life. It even describes like a cluster of samskaras become prominent. They carry to your next life, and according to which ones arise at the end of your life, due to your activities during your life generally, then those ones get played out, and then the other ones remain dormant. So your ayus, your lifespan, your bhoga, your enjoyment, your jati, your birth, whether it's human, whether it's animal, the store of karma, the asads, contains the impressions of deeds, samskaras performed throughout countless previous lives. It's like a fishing net covered with knots, and the entire collective determines one's future birth. So it's like knots. it's so many clusters, and it determines. At death, says Vigyan Bhikshu, the subtle body or chitta, which is where the karma saya, the storehouse of karma, and all the samskaras are stirred, transfers into the new body. The subtle body is not destroyed at death as the gross body is, and thus samskaras are preserved from life. Therefore, we see in children different personalities from life that, you know, that come. I remember when I grew up, when I was earlier, when I first became a devotee, there was this one child in India who was born from a guru's family. His name was Bal Yogi. They used to call him Guru Maharaji. And he was giving lectures when he was four. He was already giving lectures when he was 4 years old, so he became a child prodigy. And then he came to America and had so many disciples. Of course, at the age of 16, he married his secretary. His mother was furious and renounced him. I mean, it's a whole other story. But I remember they rented out the Astrodome, and there were 50,000 people there. And a lot of people were opposing it because it seemed to be so bogus. But I remember, if you read the Village Voice at that time, it gives a line. It said, but the real opposition with the Krishnas or something, they said, whose enthusiasm belied their frail looks. Anyway, so the subtle body is not destroyed. Now, whereas some karma says the subtle body is not destroyed, is at death is the gross body, and thus some scars are preserved from life to life. What you put in is going to stay with you. Now, whereas some karma contained in the karma sacrifice in the very next life, not all karma is destined to do so. Some karma might be mutually exclusive with other karma and not be able to consist and coexist in the same life, said Shankara. For example, one may have some karma that merits a celestial birth and other karma that requires an animal birth for fruition. Clearly, these two sets of samskaras require distinct births in which to fructify. In general, the cluster of karma that does not fructify in the next class may undergo three possible outcomes. It can be destroyed if you perform yoga. It can merge with more dominant karma, or it can remain dormant for a long time, overshadowed by more powerful karma. So, it says, this means that at the moment of death, the particular cluster of samskara is destined to fructify in the next life, a rise wave, according to the Chastity, and not only propel the chitta into the next body, but also determine the specific mindset. Interesting. There's different ways. It's prarabdha karma which is manifest. There's sanchitta karma. It's the karma that has not been activated yet, that's resting the store. And then there is the sanchiyamana karma, which you're generating now. There's karma that's already manifest, there's karma you're generating now, and there's residual karma from your last life. Now, a perfected soul destroys the karma. Even if he's within this body, then there's a question whether the prarabdha stays. But basically, you know, you're sick, you're ill, that may continue. The example is given, when you pull out a plug, the fan still goes, or the pot spins the wheel when he stops, it still spins for a while. So when we give up egotistical activity and stop acting on the basis of the mind, but act and identifying with the mind and the self, and we start to act based on discrimination or booty or love or devotion, and we're on that platform, we can stop the karma. That residue, who knows what's going to come up, that residual karma can be finished, and you won't create any more karma. Then you just have to play out this life, and then you become liberated. So these types of birth, the type of birth, lifespan, and life experience bear the fruits of pleasure and pain as a result of the performance of vice and virtue. Okay, I'm stopping now. Would anybody like any questions? That was a lot, I think.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Hare Krishna, Gail.
I just want to clarify for myself the connection between kleshas and karma. And to do that, I first had to confirm that kleshas is the various types of sufferings that we experience.
Kleshas are the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering is ignorance. And these are different manifestations of ignorance that force us to act basically selfishly. And therefore, they're the cause of karma. And they're the cause of all trouble, because karma, Prabhupada defines in the Bhagavad Gita that karma is the acceptance of a body. Only for karma do you have a body. And only having a body do you suffer. And the cause of it is this ignorance and its many manifestations. Unless you get free of that misconception. Which is a desire to be the enjoyer, which forces the pure self to identify with the non-self, is the cause of all suffering. So that's the root of it, is these kleshas. They're the cause, they're literally means torment, but the way it torments is that it attaches you to the body. Pain and pleasure is relative to the attachment that you have to the body. I remember an example when I first came to India. I was performing not voluntarily, in one sense, I was accepting my mission, my life's mission, my service to be in India and do what I had to do for my Guru Maharaj. But but I remember from that austerity, and what austerity does when you have the appropriate austerity, difficulty imposed on the body in the appropriate way as a result of your seva, I guess, then you extract yourself from absorption to the body. And therefore, you less intensely feel the discomforts and pain of the body. I remember because there was so many austerities. I remember when I went back to the West and my father took me to the dentist. The dentist was amazed at my level of tolerance to pain. Because in the same sense, if one enjoys and indulges oneself without restriction in the pleasures of the senses, then one identifies with the body more to extract that pleasure, and therefore also suffers more because of it. Okay, Gail?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, okay. Anybody else like to say anything or say hello or ask a question?
Father Krishna,
please
accept my humble obeisances. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Thank you. Oh, Ami, is that you? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Great.
Looking forward to the weekend.
I'm really happy, you know, because you're hearing regularly. And again, without hearing, it's very hard to desire the truth and become inspired and love the truth. Hearing
I'm very grateful we have these sanghas.
Prabhupada said that hearing is the first essential. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Govardhan.
I'll also see you this weekend.
Yes, Maharaj.
Yeah, I'll be looking forward to seeing your family. Is everyone's back now from India?
Yes, Maharaj.
When did they return?
Yes.
When did they all return?
Oh, they came 3 weeks back.
3 weeks back, okay. Great. They'll tell me when I see them on Sunday, your family can tell me about their experience in Vrindavan. I'd like to hear. Okay, thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, thank you all. Anchakalpa Trubya Shakrita Sindhu Veva Japati Grampadane Village.